floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiplett, and you are listening to the 200th episode of Walking the Floor. Cue fireworks, people. 200th episode. We finally crossed that line. I guess that means we go into heavy syndication and I make billions and billions of dollars, because I'm pretty sure that's how podcasting works. God, I haven't dropped an episode in a while, and the music industry's been wiped out, man. Nancy Griffith, Tom T. Hall, Charlie Watts, legends. All these legends. Pour a little out for the deceased. Really sad. It's all sad, but Charlie Watts, I don't know, that one hit me extra hard. As a lifelong Stones fan, I can honestly tell you that my earliest childhood memories are of my brother's Stones records and listening to that dude's backbeat. So, rest in peace, one and all. I've been kind of MIA on the podcast, I know, because we've been getting back into the touring life. And on that end, let me just say, Alaska, who the hell knew? What a great state. Boisterous crowds, salmon and trout literally jumping into your lap, just begging to be caught. It was amazing. Insane. I've never been. Most of us had never been. I think it's like the last state that I've never been to was Alaska, and I can't wait to go back. It was just simply great. The people, the shows, everything. Lots of great Alaskan hospitality while we were up there. And the Midwest shows were fantastic too, and hopefully everybody stays safe and healthy, and we just continue doing shows, and the tour shall ramble on. All right, let's talk about our good friends, Zounds.com. You know them, you love them. They have free shipping on every order, no exceptions, no exclusions. Zounds.com has three warehouses strategically located all across the United States, so you can get your musical instrument gear faster than anyone else can do it. Zounds.com. All right, let's get to the interview. All right, my guest this week is Mr. Charlie Worsham, fantastic singer, songwriter, guitar player extraordinaire out of Nashville, born and raised in Mississippi. I've had the pleasure of playing live with Charlie, of recording with him, of course, just being a fan of his, and I can tell you, his incredible talent is really only surpassed by what a great guy he is. This is one of the best guys out there. He's just always a good hang. I always like seeing him. Every time I see him, it puts a smile on my face. And sitting down and doing this interview with him was no exception. We covered Parenthood, his new EP, Sugarcane, produced by none other than Jay Joyce, his magic ES-335, gifted to him as a wedding present by his mentor, Vince Gill. And, of course, the joy of stealing Marty Stewart's bus rug, which he did as a little kid. There's nobody else I'd rather spend my 200th episode talking to. This is Mr. Charlie Worsham on Walking the Floor.
I ain't a killer, but I let that bastard drown.
How are you, buddy? Is that like your home man cave studio or something?
It is. I've never had a room like this until getting married and moving into this house, and I love it. It's all my stuff. This is my dad's old drum kit.
Oh, wow.
My first memory of music is sitting in his lap and banging on the drums.
Yeah.
And, my rhinestone jackets. That's Marty Stewart's bus rug.
Yeah.
He played my hometown when I was a kid, man, and got rained out like five songs in. Had to get out of there. It was getting muddy and stuff, and they forgot and left their little bus mat that they threw out outside the door. I asked my mom, I begged, can we please take it for every morning till I left home, and I woke up, and that's the first thing my feet hit.
Does Marty, since I'm assuming you, obviously you know Marty now, but does he know that you have his bus rug?
He does. I told him, I played that late night jam he does at CMA Fest every year, and at the Ryman, and I was on the stage. I was nervous as hell because I'd just gotten my record deals. One of my first times to officially sort of be out there with him on. And I was like, man, I got to confess, you know, I stole your bus rug. He's like, oh, that's all right. I stole Connie Smith's bus rug.
And then her heart.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. Yeah,
I'm looking at you in that area, like as a married man myself, who's got older kids. I could read that a couple ways. Like you've got, you know, you've built your home studio, or it's your wife's like, get all your shit out of the rest of the house. Stick it in one place where we don't have to see it.
I'll tell you. Well, so right now we've got a kid who isn't even mobile, right? But I have a feeling there will be a switch over in the years to come to where it makes more sense to have an external space, you know, but
yeah,
this will be a playroom at that point or something.
Oh, dude, I remember when my kids were first born, my garage was kind of like my home studio kind of set up, and just little by little, it got taken over by like old cribs and strollers and, you know, bikes and what. I just had to move out of there.
We think we have a lot of gear, man. Babies are gear kings. It's nuts.
Oh yeah. Have you toured with your baby yet?
I have not, but I'm living for it. That's the dream to me. Cause I grew up traveling. My mom is a school teacher, or was a school teacher at the time. You know, she's got a different kind of role now, but she just believes in travel. So she took, by the time I left home, man, I'd been to Europe half a dozen times and all over the states and stuff, which is saying something for a kid from Mississippi.
Yeah. But,
so that's what I want to do as a parent now.
Well, I always give young parents, you know, new parents, my advice for new parents is travel as much as you can while your kid is still can't walk. Cause it seems really hard when you first do it, but you don't realize how much easier that is than the next phase when your kid is a toddler. And it's basically like, you know, it's like having your drunk friend with you all the time, just running around and grabbing people's stuff and throwing things. And
Yeah. Well, we might have to do that. We've been talking about Asheville, and I want to make a Memphis trip and hit some, it's funny, man. I want to be a tourist in my own home state.
Right. You know? Right. It's fun to do. Yeah. With the perspective of having a little bit of seasoning. Look, we got a lot of stuff to get to, your new EP, Chief, amongst that. But first, I want to start with like the really important stuff, which is how the fuck did you get so good on guitar? I want to hear I want to hear who taught you, what were you listening to? Like, what was the musical environment? You said your dad was a drummer. Like, what was like your journey for people that don't know you? I mean, I don't want to just blow smoke up your backside or whatever, but like, you're one of the best guitar players that I know. I mean, you're like an amazing, amazing, just gifted player on a lot of levels. Chris,
thank you, man. That gosh, coming from you, that means a whole heck of a lot, man. I mean, I feel like being in Nashville, and you can relate to this, but being in Nashville kind of ups your game anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's like I've been on musical steroids these 15 years that I've been here. But my backstory and influences, and, you know, I talk about Mississippi a lot, but it's for good reason, because I grew up sort of triangulated between Stax and Muscle Shoals.
Mm.
And over the course of my life, I've just become a deeper and deeper and deeper fan of those records and the players. And the early on influences for me were the Beatles and the Stones. That's what my dad grew up on. First rock concert he took me to was the Stones, and it was all about Keith Richards for me. Then on the countryside, it was Vince Gill. You know, he's my North Star as a player. And the way that he was always quick to shine the spotlight on the musicians, and my dad being a liner note reader, I became a liner note reader. And so by virtue of being a fan of Vince, I made my way to the Albert Lees of the world and all of that. But then in Mississippi, I grew up 20 minutes, you know, east of the edge of the Delta in Hill Country. So BB King records were huge for me. Because I thought they would be easy to learn when I first got an electric, which they weren't. But the way he bends the note, I mean, even on my EP, the way I bend the notes is so me trying to be BB, and it doesn't come out like that. It comes out like me, as it does for all of us. But he was my first guitar teacher. And then in between, and Skinner was huge, huge, huge. Like, I own an Explorer because and solely because I wanted to be Alan Collins when I was a kid, and
right.
Now I can handle that. And
Steve I'll have you know, I was just looking at a wood grain 76 Explorer on Reverb for that very reason. But that's neither here nor there. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, man. The wood grain. No, 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 man. That's it. Like mine is black, but like had I been able to get the wood grain. I remember going to Gruen's, and we make a lot of trips to Nashville. And I remember going to Gruen's and like wanting to play the Explorer, you know.
Oh, yeah.
That's all I could think about. But man, somewhere in there. So I had the good fortune of taking the long way to guitar. So my mom got me in piano lessons, which was great for me because I visualize music still on piano keys, even though I don't really play it. And then I really wanted a guitar. A trip to Nashville, seeing Mike Snyder play at Opryland, changed that. He's a banjo player. And so I came home, I begged for a banjo. She found a $50 Sears and Roebuck. And then I became a bluegrass kid. And to sort of put off me getting a, not that she didn't want me to play guitar, but I think she thought guitar was going to mean long hair and tattoos and, you know.
It does. It usually does. She wasn't wrong.
But all the things that mothers, you know, probably just dread, you know, and whatnot. And so I got a mandolin and I got a dobro. Well, I didn't get a dobro till way later, but fiddle. And so I started learning all these other instruments to varying degrees of interest and ability or whatever. And went off in the world of Jimmy Martin and Earl Scruggs and,
right,
you know, flat. And so when I did finally get a guitar, it was like B.B. King, learning on like a George Jones, Bradley Barnes sessions record because all the songs were three chords. And then I was in bands, you know, first bluegrass bands. And then in high school, like my job through high school was playing in a bar band, man. That was probably the best music education anybody can have as a guitarist. And thankfully, I had parents that, you know, understood that I was going to the bars to play 4 hours of music with guys that were basically my chaperones. They were all grown dudes and had families. And
were you playing? So you mentioned your dad being a drummer. Were you playing with your dad in that time?
We would always jam at the house, but this was a group of guys that he knew by virtue of the sort of local music scene there. And right. So these were like the next generation of local musicians. Right. But I remember my dad's gigs. They had a rehearsal at the house once. And it was the first time I saw adults enjoying life the way kids did. And
right.
Made me kind of stop and go, wow, whatever this is has a power on adults that makes them more fun. And I want to do that if I can.
Wow, that's a really good way of looking at what we get to do for a living. I never really thought about it like that, but that's totally true. I mean, I guess that's why so many of us live in a sort of state of arrested development, you know?
Totally. But we all should be in close connection with our inner child, you know?
Right, yeah.
It's a healthy way to live.
It's really fascinating. I didn't realize that you were such a multi-instrumentalist until I think I maybe saw you, you know, watch some footage of you on YouTube playing with Old Crow and maybe playing banjo or something. Because I knew you as a guitar player, you know. But having recently worked in the studio with you, you know, on that stuff that we've been recording with Jaron and seeing the way you bounce between instruments and layer stuff, I mean, it's amazing to watch. Like, it's so fun to see that and the sort of the you know, the layering that occurs, like a lot of that stuff that you seemingly were just kind of playing. And I realize this is like stuff that nobody's heard because not yet, but like things that you're playing just kind of it seemingly off the cuff. Now in listening to the mixes of those recordings are like the hooks of the songs. And so it's really powerful, like the banjo parts and the, you know, layering some of that other acoustic guitar stuff on it. It's really interesting. So that was there from the get go for you.
Well, it was, and it all comes back to like watching Vince and like my dad, but also the way Vince, you know, hosted himself and his band. Like, it was important to know that that was John Huey playing steel guitar, and he used to play steel guitar for Conway Twitty, you know, and he played on this Willie Nelson record and all this, and reading the liner notes. And then fast forward when I'm in high school, it turns out Norbert Putnam was living in my hometown when I was in high school. He produced Joan Baez and Margaritaville. He's one of the original Muscle Shoals guys, played bass for Elvis and all this stuff. And he took me under his wing and had recording equipment. And so I became a studio nerd pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And so working with you in the studio, like where that part of my brain formed was getting my hands on recording gear. Norbert let me kind of, for basically nothing, buy his setup. So all of a sudden I'm in high school and I have a multi-track recorder at home.
Wow.
And so I started experimenting with it. And through that and playing in the cover band, I had to start singing and writing songs out of necessity. I really just kind of wanted to play and like build things on a recorder somehow. But I ran out of songs to record, and in a four-hour gig in a night, you know, you got to spread the love vocally and help out. So I had to start pulling my weight one way or another.
So but you,
man,
you,
I that's my thing.
You learned to sing playing in cover bands and bars, like not in church, because it seems like a lot of people that I interview want, like their path was learning to sing in church, and then that kind of became country music for them, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, church and music was a part of it for me. The bluegrass band I was in played a bunch of church stuff, and you know, I was in school choir a little bit here and there, but none of that really took the way that, you know, honky tonk music in a bar or rock and roll music in a bar did. Yeah. Oh gosh, what was I gonna? What I will say about church music, this goes back to Mississippi. But I got invited to be in the band at a black church in Mississippi. And that was, you know, the two or three times I got to sit in with the band at Pilgrim's Rest, just north of the town I grew up in Mississippi. Now, that was some church music that laid right. some wisdom on me, you know.
Really? Was that like a full, you were playing guitar at that point?
Playing electric, man. Yeah, oh, a little wow. Fiesta Red Strat through one of those Fender amps, the one that now that we know better is not the Fender amp you want, the right. DeVille, I think.
Right,
and,
right.
And it was drums, bass, B3, and then me, and man, it was
like unreal. Playing hard gospel
and sort of film scoring the sermon, all improvised as you go. And it
really
was
wow. Yeah. That must have given you a real insight into sort of playing around the vocal, I would think.
Yes. Yeah. And I didn't even realize that at the time, but that's a good point, where your job is to frame the front person, which in a band is the singer, obviously.
But, yeah. And, I think I learned that lesson like a month ago. You're lucky you learned it in high school.
Dude, I feel like I've relearned that lesson every couple of weeks, you know.
Right. Oh, I don't play right over the vocal. Okay, you say yeah. So.
Yeah.
You mentioned Vince Gill as being a big influence. I mean, I hear that not only, you know, in your guitar playing and songwriting stuff, but vocally a lot. You know, like you have a really pure singing voice.
Well, thanks, man. That's Vince, and you know his background in bluegrass, I think, is a part of what you hear when he sings that way.
Right.
And also, I guess we just were born to be high singers.
High lonesome.
Yeah, man. I mean, that's the stuff for me. If I'm trying to get my emotion across as a singer, I've finally started to figure out the higher I push it, the more that comes through.
Right.
Just for me. That doesn't work for everybody, but that definitely is true for me.
I know you've played with Vince Gill over the years, and he's been like something of is mentor the right word? Like he's been you have a friendship, a relationship with him. How did that come to be? How did you go from, you know, being a kid in Mississippi playing in a high school cover band or whatever to hanging out with that dude and getting pearls of wisdom from Vince Gill?
Well, he's a pretty generous guy. And so my having him as a mentor isn't a one-off. There are a lot of people in this town who could say that about how he's been to them in terms of encouragement and stuff. But where we first really connected was I had just gotten my deal on Warner and was putting out my debut record, Rubber Band. And I had this song called Tools of the Trade. I really wanted Vince and Marty to be guests on, because the song is about, you know, going down the same road my heroes paved. And Vince and Marty are my two, you know, the two pillars on which I build my country music universe. And they both said yes. And with Vince, we went to his house, the studio there at his house. And that was the first time we really connected, and he played and sang on it. And then through the years, we got to know each other a little better. And he was doing a tour one year, and he had been producing Ashley Monroe, who was also on Warner at the time. And he kind of realized that both Ashley and I were struggling to get some traction. And so in perfect Vince fashion, he calls us up and he calls his daughter Jenny, and he's like, look, they used to tour these variety shows where you'd have the one person kind of host it, but then everybody in the, he's like, I think it'd be fun. We all get on the bus together and we each sing each other songs and kind of jam out and make it like a family kind of thing. And so next thing I know, I'm on the bus with Vince, wow, actually, and Jenny, and, you know, we're playing a couple of my songs, playing a couple of their songs. And then I started getting called a couple of years after that to actually just straight up be in the band. And the crazy connection from that to today is, when I first went out on the road with him, and, you know, he's got a zillion guitars or whatever and loves them and plays them. He doesn't just collect them. He's got them because he wants to play them.
Sure.
So he calls me before tour. He's like, man, is there anything you want to borrow of mine? I got so many instruments, you know, and I'm freaking out. I'm like, man, I love 335s. And so first day of the tour, there's a 335 on my guitar stand, and it's one of his, and lets me borrow them. Fast forward, I get married, and he calls me. He's like, man, I got a wedding present for you. Come on to the house. And I'm sitting here driving to Vince's house thinking I'm going to get a toaster, some stuff, you know.
gift certificate to William Sonoma. Yeah.
Yeah, right. He points to this case, and, oh, I just lose it. But I open up the case, and it's that 335.
Oh, man.
.neck, like Excalibur, man.
Wow.
And so then where we really sort of cemented our bond, and where I feel I learned the most from him, was being in his band in 2019. I was bouncing between that and the Okra gig, but man, it was a mighty, mighty, mighty band. Paul Franklin and Jet Hughes was in the band, and I was standing next to Wendy Moten, and we did a lot of the backgrounds. I learned a whole lot about singing that year being on that gig, as much as I did being a player.
Really? I mean, you were already very seasoned before that. Like, what sort of things did you learn about? Like, how did that evolve your singing and playing?
I think that something, you know, like I said, you know, way back in high school days, I was a reluctant singer because I just love playing. And even to this day, and you can probably relate to this too, there's a slight annoyance, as much as I love being the star or whatever on stage. There's an annoyance when I can't just focus on playing my guitar, because I don't like to split my brain. I want to just nail the part. And when I'm singing or being the guy, I can never play guitar as well as I want to.
They both sort of steal from each other, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Oh, and I feel like that's just an endless pursuit that you never reach a place where you're satisfied, you know? But in my role in Vince's band, I did sing harmonies, which is a nice happy medium. And what I realized after the fact, and this was true with the old Crow gig too, when you're singing harmonies, your job being to match the phrasing of the singer. A singer as good as Vince, who has incredible phrasing, I didn't even know it until the other day this hit me. I was like, oh, that's why my voice changed so much after that year on the road with Vince. I was spending a year practicing his phrasing and practicing pitch, because I wasn't singing my thing or how I would just naturally do it. I was studying,
right,
in a real live ammo experience, a version of that. And that's where I think things shifted. And this Sugar Candy piece, I sing differently than I do on records before. And some of that's Jay, without a doubt. A lot of that's Jay. But I think a lot of it's the gigs I played in the year before.
Well, okay, so with Jay Joyce, now I know that you played on that new Eric Church stuff. Did Sugarcane sort of evolve out of that experience, or did you and Jay Joyce already have a working relationship prior to that?
We'd worked once before on another Eric record called Chief, which was the one where he really kind of exploded.
Yeah. Oh, you played on that record?
A little bit. I played, there's a song called Keep On, and I'm playing like a spanky guitar. And the funniest thing about that, this was the perfect introduction to Jay one could have. This is back when he was working in his basement out in Belle Meade or whatever. I show up, it's like 8-9 o'clock at night, you know, and it's like the Eric's band is just sitting around. There's like pot smoke. You know, you just got to like wave out to see. He hands me a chord. I have my little Strat. He hits play. I don't even know what I'm playing into. And he's just like, play, let's check it out. And I play through the song. And he's like, cool, man, let's play it again. And I played it again. And then at the end of the second pass, I'm like, all right, I think I'm ready to, you know, try this thing. And he's like, oh, man, you're done. You know, it kind of gets you by surprise.
Yeah.
And played some acoustics as well. It was a really fun studio experience there. I'm a sucker for producers, man. I mean, working with you with Jaren's, same thing. I love watching producers do their thing. But then fast forward to the sessions in Banner Elk at the top of 2020. I had just gotten enough songs where I knew I was getting ready to do the studio part of the journey. Warner was getting excited about a couple of the songs, and I'd locked in the new manager. And to that point, I had made my records with some people I dearly love, who I think are some of the best producers in the world. And in one case, Eric Massing, my gosh, he was in my wedding with me. I was in his wedding, and he made that Way to These Wings with Miranda Lambert. And I'd made all my records with Eric, and made one with Frank Liddell, who I am crazy about the records he makes, but knew everybody up to that point. And here I am working on this Eric record with Jay, and we had all this time to kill because they cut at night and they were writing the songs during the day. So we're spending the day playing records for each other. And I'm going, man, I really dig Jay, and I know him enough and I trust him. And I can tell from this second experience with him, I'm going to like working with him. But I don't know him well enough to pull some of the stunts that I would pull with my friends, which was like, man, on my first record, I comped my own vocal on one of the songs. Like, what? That was a terrible idea. But when you're with your buddies, you can get away with stuff like that, you know?
Right.
So it was sort of like the principal was in the room a little bit. And I think I needed that. He could shut me down in a way that your friends can't stop you from doing.
And you trust him.
And I trust him. And specifically, Jay is like you and I in that we're very much players, and we sort of live and breathe in that world. That's where we come from. That's our native tongue. And so when he needed something from me, I learned communication was quick and there was no translation to be done.
Right.
And
I think that was a big thing. Yeah, it's interesting with Jay Joyce, because I think of him, even though he's got like, you know, remarkable mainstream country success. I mean, you know, the Eric Church is as big as it gets, you know. I think of him as a bit left of center in Nashville, you know, the way his records sound and his approach. But listening to your new EP, there's something very like classic about it and the production. Like it's and I don't mean like classic honky tonk. It's not like a nostalgic throwback thing, but there's like, it's got almost like a, I don't even know what I'm looking for. Like a fresh take on like more like 90s era in a way that you just don't really hear a whole lot of in country music now.
Thanks, man. I think it comes down to, well, there's a couple things. So, and we talked about this, like working on your project, a lot of times, what a record calls for is layering a bunch of things.
Yeah.
And I would always do that on my records. I mean, you give me 3 hours in a song, I want to put every instrument I own on that. I want to triple everything,
that. Yeah.
And it's cool. But I think when you're trying to break out, which I'm still trying to do, you know, 15 years in, you kind of have to fit your vibe onto a postage stamp.
I
don't know that people were making the connection to, hey, this dude's playing all these things on his record. And so Jay was like, dude, I want you to pick one guitar, like one electric guitar. Don't bring all your acoustics, bring a couple things, but, you know. And I borrowed an amp from John Osborne, old Tweed Deluxe, which now I'm searching reverb.
Now you're not giving back.
And so there was that, and it was a live band on the floor, really, for the most part. But I didn't do a bunch of overdubs. I'd play that one electric thing.
Was it that Vince Gill 335?
Heck yeah, it was.
It had to be, right?
It had to, man. There was no other. And, man, I never realized how versatile 335s are, because a lot of the twangier tones, you just roll the volume down halfway, and it's
right.
completely different animal.
Yeah.
And so I think that was a big part of it. And I was with musicians I've played a ton on. I mean, Jerry Rowe on drums, who
we were
working with
on
your stuff. And I love that dude. My buddy Rachel Loy, I've known her since I moved to town playing bass. And she is just stellar. Billy, Justin O, is playing a little bit of keys. And Jay goes in too, you know, and he does his thing, his little mad scientist thing.
Well, that's that begs an interesting question for a guy like you who's been in Nashville for a minute, who's a very well-established player and session player. Like, how do you figure out who's going to play on your stuff? I imagine you have a personal relationship with all the first call guys in town. Like, how do you sort of put that together?
Gosh, it's been different every record. I mean, my first record, I had a little more of a deciding vote on that. And I mean, Jed Hughes was one of the first calls I made. I'd been introduced to Craig Wright and Lee Hendricks, who are in Eric Church's band, and they were the rhythm section for that first record. And then on the second record, I kind of turned things over to Frank Liddell, and he has a completely different Rolodex than me. I mean, there's some overlap, but man, you know, and I was like, man, I want to get Brian Sutton, because Brian's one of my favorite players.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, no, man, I'm going to put you in a room with Matt Chamberlain and this guy named Lex Price, who's killer, played bass and some mandolin stuff. And then Luke Reynolds, who played a bunch of guitars on that second record. So I was being introduced to new folks the second time around. The third time around was like it's like the Goldilocks story. I think with Jay, it was a back and forth, and because Jay wants people to use their band. He's like, well, who are your people? You know, and at the time I'd been playing a bunch with Jerry Rowe on other records, and we played some gigs together. It's like, man, I really dig Jerry Rowe, and like, he's got his own thing, but he also understands how to fit things into the Nashville world without taking the cool out of it. Right. And then Rachel is one of my oldest friends, and I just think Rachel is like one of the best kept secrets in session world here in Nashville, because she's just killer. She's so killer. And so that was the core. And then Jay brought in Spencer Cullum, who plays in Miranda's band, has his band Steelism, plays on some other records, you know, and stuff, but a steel guitar and a little bit of slide guitar kind of stuff. And that became the band, the four of us.
So
but it's hard not to call everybody. I know, because I love everybody, you know.
I bet. And you're like a beloved guy there. You're one of those people that like nobody. I've never encountered anybody that has a crossword to say about you. So you know, like, yeah, it's funny. On that tip, there one of the songs on the CP I wanted to ask you about, because I remember when I think it was maybe the first song that popped up off it, that Fist Through This Town, with just the title alone, I was like. It sounded like, you know, I mean, don't take this wrong. It just sounded like an edgier, angrier, like concept for a song than I would kind of associate with you. You know what I mean? Because you don't seem like a pissed off dude. But even in reading the lyrics, like, I mean, I think anybody that's been in this business in any of its forms for any amount of time can very much relate to that song. Like, even when you're successful in this business, I want to put my fist through this fucking town just about every day of my life. You know, I think that's something that a lot of people can relate to. But what is it about for you? What is it about like this business and maybe the city of Nashville and the industry that sort of generates that feeling for you?
Well, that song in my heart, where I think that comes from specifically, is the year 2014. Which was the year that first album on Warner kind of died. And I was stuck on the road I didn't have time enough to process that heartbreak. And I didn't have time to start working on the next thing. And I was on some really, you know, tours that a lot of people would have killed to be on, and they were good tours for me. But a lot of times these tours get booked, you know, almost a year in advance, or like, I think this one was like 9 months in advance. And in the 9 months between booking and tour, the guy going on first, Sam Hunt, had exploded. And then my record had died. And so he was going on for 15 minutes and then I was going on for 45, and the crowd was confused as to why that was happening. And I can't blame the crowd, but I did. And I was angry on stage a lot. I took it out on the crowds, took it on myself, took it out on my band. I would get back in my bunk and read every negative comment on Twitter. Right. And that's the place, that song, I think, where the seed got planted for that song. But where it really, I think, took off was as my life started to get built around more than the music, getting married. And, you know, my dad had a 40-something year career in banking, and I watched it go from this thing that he got into because he loved and he could be a helpful person in the community to just corporate America. You know, well, let's put your numbers in the computer and see if we can give you a loan versus shake your hand and, you know, bet on a person.
Right.
And so it was all of those frustrations and realizing, well, I'm not just fighting, because the last thing in the world that song is intended to be is like, oh, look at poor pitiful me playing music for a living, you know.
Which, but by the way, is not how I read it. You know what I mean?
No, no. And I don't think I didn't take it that way.
Yeah.
But I want people to know, you know, for me, you know, my frustration with the industry is that, like a lot of things, well, you could take sports, for example. I mean, if you're the greatest basketball player in the world, if you're LeBron James or Michael Jordan, you're going to be LeBron or Jordan. Like, you're going to be brought to that team and made the star player and get the championship rings. But music doesn't really work that way.
Right.
Corporate America doesn't.
There's a huge, huge infrastructure, and I think people maybe don't understand if they're not in it, between you, the artist, and the public. There's a whole bunch of people and gatekeepers that your music has to pass through. And a lot of things have to align: luck, hard work, support, yada, yada, for it to ever get here. And then to when it reaches the public, we have no control really over how it's organically received, you know?
That's right. And so you see really amazing talent get overlooked. And that was something I felt that I could relate to, but I saw it in friends.
Yeah.
But I also think about going all the way back to little old Grenada, Mississippi, and like the handful of people that, like me, got in their car and drove to a new town and tried to start something new there. And like, I've got a buddy that's a chef in Portland. And so that song to me is it's my buddy in Portland, you know, shutting down a kitchen at 1 a.m. and then getting up and doing it all over again because he loves to cook.
Right.
But that's the gig, you know,
the hustle.
There's unsavory parts to it.
Yeah. Okay. So there was a quote, and this kind of ties into that, that I read of yours that I thought was really interesting, where you said, "It's not lost on me that most people in my position would have been dropped by now." Worsham says, who adds that he's grateful for his label's continued support. So, like, considering that, and, you know, you've put out a couple of records over the years and you got this new one and you're still on Warner, like, how have you sort of navigated that side of things? Like, the expectations of your label, because of course any label wants the most, you know, commercial success or whatever. And we know this is an unforgiving business in that regard. And how have you sort of, you know, how have you kept your deal and kept your place in that very, very fickle industry?
Yeah. Well, Chris Lacey, who's A&R at Warner, and is really the reason I got a deal there. She waved the flag for me. And Espo, who runs the label, have both just over the years repeatedly given me votes of confidence. I remember once, I think it was after my second record didn't do much, Espo brought me in his office and he said, he like cranked up of like a very obscure song. And he's like, "Man, we want to do business with you, whether you want to sell out Bridgestone or if you want to be these guys or whatever. He's like, well, we want to figure it out. And so we've always been able to figure it out. And then even in the, what, 8 to 12 years, I guess it's 12 years now that I've been putting music out, the industry, country has changed so much.
Dramatically. Yeah, sure.
Dramatically, the way people consume music has changed so much. And I think throughout all of that, so I had that year in 2014 where I was really emotionally and mental health wise in a low point. But there's a place in town called Porter's Call that offers free therapy and counseling for artists. So I took my ass to Porter's Call and got my shit squared, you know?
Really?
And I think, oh man, big, big part of me still getting to do this, I think, is setting my mental alignment, you know, the way it needed to be. And not that this is the deciding factor, but I think what it is that it's a dance. And there is a cool factor for Warner with me being on that roster. You know, they're not going to point to me and go, hey, when they're trying to sign somebody and be like, we made this guy a multi-platinum artist, but they might point to me and go, look, we got Charlie and he plays on all these records, you know, and that's the kind of label we are.
We're a nurturing label for artists. Right.
That's right. Which they are. And I mean, we've butted heads like any good relationship over the years does.
Sure.
But then on my end, I think I've held up the bargain in that I don't make the same mistakes twice. I have consistently tried new things. I've consistently worked hard. I've consistently pushed myself to be a better player, singer, writer, and all of those things. And especially with the mental health, I've grown to understand what you just said, which is there's this infrastructure. And Warner and I are not enemies. We're not even frenemies, but we have different functions. You know, they handle traffic in the intersecting lane to the traffic that I handle. And so we're good at checking each other. And the other secret part of this is management. I've had some great managers, but maybe not the best managers for me. And right now I've got a killer management team and we're just the right fit. And the way I see it, and I think Warner sees it, is we're doing everything we can and we recognize some of this is out, a lot of this is out of our control. But all we need is that miracle to happen. You know, all these lines in the water, I just need one bite. And that'll be it. That's the overnight. I mean, we all saw it with Stapleton on the CMAs with Justin Timberlake. And whatever that is for me, hell, it might be a TikTok. And as crazy as that sounds, and so I'm just making myself available to the miracle every day.
Right.
And I've got a little bit of clock still to run out with Warner. And because they're going to keep re-engineering the numbers as long as they can make it work, they are. So here we are.
Wow, that's well said. What I'm gonna destroy that, but making yourself available for the miracle. I like that.
Yeah,
that's good. There's a song in there somewhere, Charlie. Come on,
there we go. Hey, Hands on. By the way, I just realized that you were a co-writer on Hands on a Miracle. Not to geek out on you, but man, that song kills me. I'm going to play it. I have a monthly radio show on WSM, and I'll play one of your tunes.
Oh, no way. Song.
Yeah. Oh, my God, man. It kills me. Now that I'm a dad, especially. I remember when Letterman had y'all on and playing that with a video of his son. Oh, come on, man.
Oh, man. Have you had the thing happen to you? When I became a parent, and it just continues, and my kids, you know, my oldest is about to turn 18, so it's been going on for a little while, but my sense, my inner sensitivity meter. I was at a screening last night for this documentary that my friend's working on. There was this one heavy part where this guy was talking about his father passing away and his son passing and all this stuff. And I just started, like, I was retelling the story to my friend this morning and I just started crying like uncontrollably. It was like right before I jumped on the interview with you, actually. And I was like, I got to get myself together, man. I'm a mess right now. I can't hear about other people's children suffering in any capacity. It like just messes me up, man.
Dude, I started crying this morning because I was handling baby duty with Gabe And he's just now getting old enough where you can read him a book and he'll kind of pay attention.
Yeah.
And I was reading The Little Engine That Could, breaking down in tears.
Dude, get ready. That's going to be every flight for the rest of your life, because there's something about being on an airplane that makes you extra emotional. I don't know what that is, but it, just don't watch any movie on an airplane that has the, where a kid suffers in any way. I'm telling you, it's waterworks. Okay,
thank you for that.
Well, it's okay. So, like, you know, just to wrap this up, like, you know, you're a solo artist, you're a songwriter, you're a session player in high demand. You played an Old Crow Medicine Show, you know, you tour with Vince Gill. I saw that you were just out on the road with Cadillac 3. You got a lot of stuff going on. You're a new dad. You know, there's a lot of all those things. Most of those things could be full time in their own right. You know, how do you? And it's really hard in this business. Like when you're really focused over here, you're like not dealing with something over here and vice versa and all that sort of, like, how do you sort of balance out all those things that are important?
It's easier than it used to be because my wife is a great sounding board. And being a dad is a great catalyst for just better decision-making. It's easier to say yes to the right things and no to things that, even though I really want to do them, may not be the right thing. In full disclosure, there is a part of me that would love in the next year to see, as much as I love doing the other things, I'd love to be able to straight up make my living playing my own shows and just making my own records. But the gift of doing all these other things, more than any juggling act, and with any juggling act comes, you know, sometimes frustration. It's like, how am I going to manage this? And you're low on sleep or whatever. But the gift is far greater, and the gift being every tour I've been on, backing somebody else up, or maybe it's a weird sideways tour for me to be on even as an artist, but there was some component to it that wasn't me as the artist, or playing on other people's records. I always learned something. And so to go back to that waiting for the miracle thing, if and when the miracle comes for me, I now have all of these years of wisdom that have been handed to me from everybody, from Ketch and Old Crow and Vince. I mean, gosh, man, you and Jaron working on your stuff. You know, I picked up things on those sessions. So that's the real gift of having to do all of this. You see how everybody else makes it work, and you kind of get to say, ooh, I'm gonna borrow that, or, oh, I see how that works for them, but that wouldn't work for me. And I'm glad I know that now. It's really been a gift, even though I don't think it ever becomes something where I'm just perfect at it.
Right.
Like juggling it all, but you do get better at it. And then you glean so much wisdom from wearing the different hats, I think.
Well, buddy, I'm going to let you go, and I can't wait to see you play live doing your own thing. And I'll be the guy in the audience like, going, where's your Explorer? Play some Skinner, bro.
Dude, I'll do
That'll
it,
That'll be
man.
Me. Listen for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Just request swamp music or a cool like, B-side. In the
van, there you go.
Man, this ain't no fair fight.
All right. That was my buddy, Mr. Charlie Warsham. Make sure you go out and listen to his brand new EP, Sugar Cane, out now everywhere you get your tunes. And I'll be back soon. I'm going to try to get back on a regular, you know, schedule kind of. I got a few dusty interviews in the can that I got to get out. And things have been so darn busy with the band and everything and trying to get my record finished. I might just kind of hit the pause button on the old podcast for a little while until things settle down. So we'll see. I'm kind of thinking about that because it's just kind of life has gotten real busy again. So we'll see what happens. But either way, I'll be back real soon with an interview from who do I got? I got Samantha Crane. I got Lake Street Dive. I got Lee Rocker from the Stray Cats. That one was fantastic. Completing the Stray Cats trilogy because I've already interviewed Brian and Slim Jim. Anyway, so I'll be back soon. And then we'll see what happens after that. Take care. Adios, amigos.